My name is Susan Berkelow, and the title of this particular workshop is called Introduction to Feminist Theology. I come to this workshop as a woman who considers herself a feminist theologian. I am a parish pastor. I was a parish pastor till about 10 days ago in Los Angeles, where I was working for 4 years in a bilingual parish. This presentation you're receiving today will not be a systematized, traditional format intro to Theo course, as we call them in seminary, but some sharings that I've picked up over the last few years of just discovering who I am, together with my sisters, both in lay ministry and in ordained ministry. And it's just part of a journey that I'm on. And I'm not sure exactly where I am on it, but every time I open it up again, I find myself in some new and exciting places, and just hope to open up some discussion for all of us in this matter as well. I want to start out with a story. This is a story that was originally in the San Francisco Examiner. I have it copied out of a magazine. I don't have the name of the magazine here. It was called It Happened in Sisterhood. The story is told by a woman from Berkeley named Louise Lacey. She's a writer and a researcher, and in her writing and researching, she came upon this particular incident, which I think points out, maybe gives one place to start of the many there may be. It says, Frances Peavy was walking on the Stanford campus with a male companion one day when she saw some people gathered in a loose circle around a natural glen. These people, apparently press and scientists, were holding cameras and videotape equipment. In the center of the circle, a male chimpanzee was being introduced to a female chimp, shackled on a long chain. The male made grunting mow, mow, mow noises, and the female whimpered and backed away. The male grabbed at her chain, pulling her toward him. She pulled back. He hauled her toward him again. She pulled back. He hauled and she pulled, and the suspense was building. And Peavy was noticing how expressive the chimp's faces were. She began to feel an agony of sympathy for the female, especially since the crowd of onlookers was predominantly male. At last, the female chimp yanked loose, walked straight to Peavy, and took her hand. Then this chimp led her across to the only two other women in the assembly, grasped one of their hands, and huddled against them, facing the crowd of males. The two groups stood looking at each other, the larger one in what must have been amazement. Finally, the scientists and the press representatives got the message and called it a day. They departed in disgust, they said, taking the chimpanzees their separate ways. Talk about biological sisterhood, exclaimed Peavy in retrospect, still aware of the chimp's rough hand against her palm. Turning to her companion, she spoke of her admiration for this powerful statement that was made by this animal who had organized her own support group. The companion stared at her blankly. He hadn't noticed. What he had noticed was the conclusion, no action. The male chimp had been unable to have his way with the female, therefore, nothing had happened. That's sometimes what is said about feminist theology. Nothing is really happening. Women have gotten together and they're taking the Bible and looking at it and doing some different things with it, but basically nothing is going on because feminist theology hasn't always fit into the molds or the forms against which theology is critiqued. It's been said that it's not new. It's been mistakenly said also that it's exclusive, that it's not traditional. And there's a little bit of truth and untruth in all of those statements. I think just to begin for ourselves, and also to get us involved a little bit in this process, I'd like to do some defining, because there are a lot of things that we can be talking about using language and not know what we're talking about, what we're saying to each other. And there's some really critical words that we need to come to some sort of common understanding about just to talk about this today. One of the words is theology. I'll give you what the words are and then we'll just share some impressions of how you would define these. The next word is feminism. What is your understanding of feminism? Third is liberation theology. How would you define liberation theology? And then the fourth one will be feminist theology. How would you put that together somehow and define feminist theology? You want to think about those for a minute. We'll just, for a minute. People have been thinking about this for a long time, but we only have an hour, so you'll have to think fast. about some ideas on theology?
I think of a person's philosophy or attitude of life. Think of Christian theology, but also think of other orders or ideas of how life should be or be lived.
Okay, an ordering of our ideas about life and how we're part of them. Okay, any other ideas on theology?
Study about God.
Okay, if you take the word apart, the word theo is God and ology is study, and that's been a traditional definition of that. Any other ideas, or if you want to invent a new idea, what would theology mean? We send people to seminary to study theology. The study of God is one traditional definition of theology. Also, people have referred to it as God talk, talk about God. It's been called languaging faith, expressing, putting faith into words, or our experience of our faith into words, bringing faith to words. But theology as such expressly has to do with how we articulate our faith, our experience of God. How about feminism? First of all, I just have to ask this. How many of you, when you hear the word feminism, experience that as a positive word? When you think feminism, oh good. How many of you think of that as a negative word? You have negative connotations then. How many of you just feel, okay, wonderful. It's really, it gives us something to work with here. Okay, what would the definition of feminism be then?
What comes to my mind is sort of militant.
Okay.
And, not being cooperative, but rather being asserting one way of looking at things instead of a cooperative way.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned three particular words. One, you were saying a dominant, a form of thought that dominates over others, militant and uncooperative. Is militant a negative word for you?
Yes.
In that context, okay.
The word feminine is a wonderful word.
Mm-hmm.
You add I-M-M, and it changes the context. I think the last 10, 15 years, it just changes the context of feminine.
To what?
Something negative, I guess, because we think of militant.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I think of it in a historic sense, so I guess I think back to the things that happened in the, well, I don't even know the dates, but with suffrage and...
late 19th century. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess when I think of feminism, I think of all that history, and I think of now, the feminism that is now as an extension. And I think of, and so to me, maybe that's why it's positive to me. I don't see it as a recent...
You think of women speaking out against slavery when others were supporting, or women speaking up for other women to be able to vote when it was said they couldn't speak, that's sort of a historical...
So that I think that's why it's
positive. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think of a feminist as being a stout champion of the rights of women. And so I think that's a wonderful thing to be. And so people who are feminists, believe in feminism somehow, it seems to me to be very positive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Feminism was initially a negative term for me, but I think as I've become educated, it's now become, I've gone through a neutral phase to a positive phase, but I think that feminism is in large part what my wife said, it's a historical movement that today just has a different focus than it had before. I think the focus in the end result of feminism is for women to be thought of in our society equally with men.
Mm.
And it doesn't mean they have to be the same as men, they just have to be thought of equally as worthwhile and as valuable as men.
What was critical to you in your movement from negative to neutral to positive?
To have my wife adopt some feminist activities.
Oh.
And to realize that I can live through them and change it with it too.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's a, sort of a good. Yeah.
I think of more of like holistic. You know, like for so long, making fun of a male dominant and not made the ultimate goal of more of a balance. Not be the same, the balance.
Yeah, two of you have mentioned the fact that equal does not mean same. Equal does not mean indistinguishable or identical, and that's an important definition also to have. Yes?
I mean, I guess it means women working for men.
Hmm, okay.
Which doesn't mean against anything, it just means for. Mm-hmm.
Right, that the choice of words is important there too. But, okay, that gives us really pretty good a rounded sort of vision of all the different things. I have a hard time sometimes when I'm asked for definitions on the spur of the moment because they do get clouded by a lot of things that people hang on to them. And but I think we've mentioned some things that really are good. Some of the things that were mentioned I think will be challenging, and others I think may come out to be pretty close to what we're saying. One traditional understanding of the word feminism from the women's movement and also within the church has been that commitment to work for the political, economic, and social equality of man and woman, boy and girl, in every area of life. It's a definition that expressed by a woman named, sorry, Mollenkott, I can't remember her first name.
Virginia.
Virginia, right, Remy Mollenkott. In her book on the divine feminine, she culled that from her work with different groups. And when Christian feminists come to that and add their own, what they would add to that, that's sort of a general feminist. Feminist does not mean Christian. Feminist is broader than that. But when we talk of Christian feminism, I think out of that would come also that idea of mutuality, a mutual concern, a mutual servanthood, and saying that that is the relational order exemplified by Jesus and the one that's specified in the New Testament. And it's also one of the things that has been said of critiques of feminist theology has been seen as an exclusively by women for women. However, I think most real feminists, true feminists, would say that if they share a commitment to that human sexual equality and mutuality, that men too can be feminists and be participant in a feminist movement. So I think that the definitions they've given don't contradict that. I think they fit in with that kind of a framework. Some of the other things that were expressed by those of you who felt were negative, I think, have to do more with how that is acted out, how that is expressed, and we can talk about that in a little bit. It doesn't really change the basic definition of that. How about liberation theology? What do we think of with liberation theology?
I've got a very positive image of that. Mm-hmm. I really, what little I know of liberation theology, I really like. I think it's very good. It's very Christian.
Mm-hmm. What does it mean to you to have liberation theology? What's the
liberation
focus?
As in liberating, as in freeing from narrowing and restricting conceptions, saying I can't do this because, and mm-hmm. having that those bonds broken, saying I can't do this because I'm a woman, but having a liberating theology.
Mm-hmm.
Saying, just because you're a woman doesn't mean you can't.
Yeah.
For example.
Yeah, I didn't even think of asking. How many of you have a positive image of liberation theology? I want to know if there's any difference in that. How about some negative connotations with liberation theology? How about neutral? Okay. Okay. Well, yeah, we're working on that now, but a lot of times we react to things before we've ever defined them, and it's good to know that at the beginning, too, because it tells us where we are, we're starting. But yeah, okay, that one liberation theology that's one good example. I think the freeing from narrow constrictions, conceptions that keep us from being or doing what we're capable of being and doing. Any other definitions of liberation theology? Okay, you think of it having a context of society, something that's applied, I guess means action. It's something that's acted out in society. It's not just study up here. Okay?
It seems to be like using your theology
your personal ideas about God and life to free you as a human being from oppression of others.
Hmm. Okay.
From physical oppression, from mental oppression, anything that restricts your freedom.
Okay. You have a comment?
Well, the only way I've been exposed to it had more to do with the South American experience.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as really looking at the whole society and the need to change society and a basis for more social activistic societal interaction with the Christian faith.
Okay, you're implying then that love rises out of that perception of the needs in society. So that's a starting place for that theology. Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm not a Christian, mm-hmm. So my experience with liberation theology is limited to Holden Village, but so far my impression is that the main focus has been on other societies as a whole, Central America or South Africa, where we're completely free to say that those places need far-ranging changes. But the discussion about our own society has been limited in great part to inclusive language. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that it's a safer issue that women as part of this community can speak out boldly in favor of inclusive language, because it's an issue which is also brought up continually by men, but don't seem to very often get into other parts of what might be called liberation theology, because perhaps if you got further into it, the men wouldn't approve.
Such as, beyond language, you have a couple of places you would want to...
Well, I think that power in the Lutheran community, at least the discussion I've heard and my experience here, is limited among women. Men are still holding on to the most of the power. And a lot of issues about interpersonal behavior, interactions between men and women that I've seen here are still following a lot of the same old patterns. And you can talk on the surface about giving women their place in the church, but I haven't seen a lot of evidence of that here.
Okay. Yeah, power is a big issue. Power is related, of course, to other things that were mentioned, like oppression or limitation, or dominance too. It's used to implement those things. And I think of all the things that were mentioned, all those are a part of liberation theology, the contextual nature of it, that liberation theology is something that interacts with society, it rises out of society. And I think especially it's the reality of God's presence in acting within the struggle of the poor and the oppressed. It's sort of how it originally came, if you say it's discovered or rediscovered, and it's hard to know how these things come about, because in a sense they've always been there, in a sense they're new every time they're lifted up. But yeah, God's special presence in that whole arena of society that had so often been ignored by theologians or by the church. God talk did not include questioning where was God's presence with the poor and the oppressed. How does that all fit together? What does that say to us in our faith? Also, the fact that action is a part of that theology, it's really been emphasized in all liberation theologies that it's a new way of doing theology, that with the doing emphasized, it's not thinking or talking only, but there's a real, it's in the acting that it takes place. Theory and praxis is intimately related. There is the reflection that goes on with the action, and they go back and forth and are tested out. And also liberation theology is very critical of ideologies. A lot of times we act not perhaps on the basis of our theology, but on the basis of what our culture has told us to be. And we're not always capable of sifting that out because it becomes so much a part of us in our growing up. And so there is that active dialogue also, that critiquing of ideologies. How about feminist theology? How would you describe feminist theology? We're talking about feminism. We talk about liberation theology. Well, drawing our conclusions as we work through these, where would we end up then on feminist theology?
Mm-hmm. I say that I have a narrow, I see that as being narrow, mm-hmm. as being exclusive
of
men.
Oh, okay.
From those two words put together, feminist theology, it is the theology for women, and my question is, well, what about the men?
What about the men?
I see it more as maybe giving a new perspective in terms of how God is viewed, you know, versus what the Bible has is written from a male perspective, mm-hmm. basically, to open up and see things as women might interpret and see God. And so it just gives a broader perspective.
Okay, so you see it as a broadening thing.
Yeah, I think it's more inclusive and gives a new way of looking at God.
So what you're saying is that it right now is narrow. And that feminist theology...
But it's been narrow in the past.
Right.
Women, it's been exclusive, not including women in many ways.
So it's not that men are being excluded, but that women are being included for the first time. So instead of having one left out, you now have two in. Yeah, okay, that's good.
That's,
is it from feminist theology then that the conclusion is drawn that God was indeed a woman?
Did somebody hear something I didn't hear? Is God indeed a woman?
Does God have genitals?
God is all things.
We'll talk about that. Feminist theology, I think, we just to move beyond this definition part, then I think part of it is the whole act, everything we said about theology, talking about God, bringing our faith to language, but also in the active sense, it's also, I think, a part of liberation theology. I don't think any of us can deny that throughout the world, throughout history, women have often and consistently been placed disproportionately, I think, also in amongst the poor and the oppressed. There has been oppression and there is oppression against women at this point in many places, and we've probably all experienced it at some point or another or seen that too. And so feminist theology is as a reflection that comes out of the experience of God from the perspective of women. And as you were mentioning, it's a perspective that has not always been heard, it's been suppressed, has not been welcomed, to say the least. And it comes bringing something to that. What would you say the experience of women is? If you were just going to list briefly some experiences of women, what are some common experiences of women? I just want to write some of these down so we... Experiences that are very common to women everywhere.
On what level? What kind of experience?
Any level.
Motherhood.
Motherhood, okay.
Fear of rape.
Economic dependence.
Cooking, housekeeping.
I'd probably add on to that too, that whole dimension of service, serving.
Friendship and support from other women.
Whatever species, right?
Yeah. Okay, well, how are you saying that as experience? Are you saying that's a lack of experience? Yes.
Okay, this is not exactly a good tape. Powerlessness is also a part of women's experience.
second-rate citizen, perhaps.
Okay, second-rate citizenship. Sort of a class, that's a class distinction.
Women are personally strong and efficient, capable. They're good managers. They manage the lives of the men and children around them.
Maybe part of this is, too, that their lives tend to be very fragmented, many parallel things going on at once, right? Which is sort of why they end up having to end.
I think women have also had a civilizing influence in history. They've had a softening effect. I'm not sure what the right word is.
Yeah, I'm not sure either what that would... I've heard the word used, humanizing.
Yeah, humanizing.
Women are humanizing.
No,
does that suit you?
Yeah.
Cooperative approach, maybe, rather than a tendency towards maybe a cooperative way of dealing with problems, rather than cooperative.
Okay, cooperative style. Yes. There's, you know, if we had more time, we could come up with a lot. We could fill this board and. Another side, I'm sure. But I think the important thing to see in this is that it's out of all of this that feminist theologizing comes. It's out of this that it all takes, it's in all this that it takes place. And the questions that are brought to the fore are also questions that come out of lives that are part of all of this dimension of our own humanity. You can see a lot of the points of intersection with other liberation theologies, for instance, too, but also the intersection with women cross-culturally, for whom this is a common experience on many different levels. And that's part of also feminist theology, that it does attempt to bridge a lot of different barriers that have set us apart. We have our European theologians, we have our Latin American theologians, and there are areas sometimes where we come together and say, hey, we're doing the same thing, and let's come together. And feminist theology is in one of these areas. I just want to mention a few of the concerns that feminist theology addresses and some of the characteristics, and then just open it up for us to discuss whatever we have to ask or to share with each other on this. One of the concerns that feminist theology rises out of, and it's been mentioned by you already, is that of the exclusion of women from some very key places. And one of the exclusion or the cutting off, one is exclusion from their own identity and their own identity with the divine. We'd read in a session yesterday some of the early church fathers who said that man is created in God's image and woman is not. And those kinds of sayings said by eminent theologians, even if they are 900 years old, are echoes that seem to go throughout history and questions that come up. But you know, what is the image of God? And it's the sort of thing that comes back to us. If men are created in the image of God and women are not, therefore, God is a man. I mean, that's very clear. If women are created in the image of God and men are not, therefore, God is a woman. But what do you do if both men and women are created in the image of God? What does that make God? You know, androgynous, I guess. But actually, what it is it broadens our concept of God, and it challenges the narrowness, our limitations, and seeing ourselves as a part of that divine image. A number of theologians refer to that struggle for identity as a struggle against non-being, a struggle against non-personhood, not having a place, not being represented. There are many ways that people have gone about doing this. Many feminist theologians go to the Bible and they look at what is there. Are you acquainted with some of the work on feminine images of God in the Bible? What is the image of God that we have from our biblical readings and studies? God is a man.
Yeah,
God as what? Father?
God as creator.
Creator? Which is creator, I don't know if you think of creator in a,
creator
in a male or female sense, or if it's just neutral for you. You feel neutral about that word, okay?
Mother.
Mother?
From just the Old Testament, or assume that you...
Take the whole Bible. Go for the whole thing.
You have all the aspects of Christ, gentle, kindness.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Angry.
Okay, you have real angry aspects of God.
Lover.
Lover.
Stern.
Hmm?
Stern.
Stern. Judgmental. Yeah. There's been a lot of work done. One of the critiques of feminist theology is that it's not been very biblical. It's not had a lot of scholarship. And that's not really true. There have been many books that have been written, both about the language of the Bible, about the images in the Bible, about those that they're there, but they're kind of lost because they're not lifted out as are the other images that we've been taught so readily. This particular book that I quoted from earlier, The Definition of the Divine Feminine, talks about different feminine imagery of God. Talks about God as Mother Bear, the God of Naomi, God as female homemaker, God as Mother Eagle, God as Mother Hen, and God is Dame Wisdom, and a couple of others. But all images that carry very strong feminine imagery with them that at least a few years ago, I think all of us would have been very hard-pressed to come up with any examples of how God would have any other images being other than being strong and forceful and all-powerful, which sometimes can be overpowering if you're feeling excluded and you're feeling excluded, left out. And, so one of the things that feminist theology has done is to lift out of the Bible what's already there. It hasn't created anything new there. It's pointed us back towards something that is there. Yes?
Does it bother women that Christ was the Son of God, Christ is put forward as a son rather than a daughter?
The question was, does it bother women if that Christ comes out in the Bible as a son of God, that Christ did not come as a daughter of God?
It doesn't bother me because I figured Christ had to be either male or female. And so you have a 50-50 chance.
Take the law of averages.
And secondly, I think it's important to consider the society into which Christ was born, and women weren't taken seriously. They weren't allowed, the opportunities for women weren't such that, that's the way I've always seen it, now that I'm talking, I'm beginning to see it maybe wrong, but I thought that a man would have so many more opportunities to do, I mean, travel alone, whereas women, that it wasn't, and that would have raised a lot more questions, and I hate to say because it was easier, but that's the
point. God chose the easier route.
I doubt that was really why.
But what you're saying is that as a man, Jesus had the freedom to perhaps do things that would not have been equally as possible to do had he been born as a woman.
Mm-hmm. I think women might be upset if Christ were going to come today. If God decided today that he was going to reveal what he was like. Mm-hmm. To us and become a human being. If hands down it was going to be a male decision again, and maybe not today, but maybe 20 years from now, I think that maybe Christ could come as a woman. I think Geraldine Ferraro, everybody knew she wasn't going to win. And we're still a little bit, you know, we're still 20 years away from maybe thinking that maybe God could reveal himself to mankind as a woman. But, you know, we're getting close. I think that's what she was saying. That,
you know, for the historical context, there was a...
Back then, there was no contest.
A woman just would
Christ
have
had to come as a man. Mm-hmm.
You asked that question. I think I've experienced with a sister who had a hard divorce, and that she has had a very hard struggle getting back in touch with the church because everything seems... There are other things, too, like the church being so family-centered when she's a single parent, things like that. But I think there are many women for whom that is a very difficult thing. If there is a lot of things to work through in your feelings about men in general, then if God and God's incarnation on earth is very male, that becomes a very difficult thing. And it stands in the way of faith.
Right, it
something
is.
Something to be overcome.
You're right, that's very true. And then on the other hand, there are also women who are able to look at the modeling, as we mentioned earlier, of Jesus' interaction with women. And what a shocking, radical thing that was to the people of Israel. We lost the sense of radical and shocking because it's not in our times, but in those times, his valuing of women was something that was really radical and revolutionary. And that's something that's out of that givenness of him coming as a man, that's is lifted out and speaks out to us as a very important message from which we can also work. Mm-hmm.
It bothers me that a lot of the qualities that Jesus displayed are lauded as evidence of Godhood, and those same qualities in women are taken for granted.
Just name a couple of those qualities that you're talking about.
Well, a kind of loving acceptance. Mm-hmm. Nurturing.
Mm-hmm. And empowering of other people, perhaps. Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
My experience of the church in the last 20 years, of the Lutheran church, and that of many of my friends, has been the contradictory feeling of feeling commanded to not hide my light under a bushel and to be fulfill myself, use my talents, develop myself, and yet every time I go to church or have anything to do with the church, I come away feeling diminished and feeling smaller and feeling less competent and less fulfilled and less able to fulfill myself. And, you know, there's a lot of study about that. There's a lot of psychological studies that have been done on the effect of a person's environment on their performance. I mean, if you're driving a car and your passenger thinks you're an incompetent person, you start driving poorly. It's measurable. You can make a difference. You know, if a teacher is told that he or she has the dummies in that school, at the end of the year, those kids test worse. Whereas if the teacher is told that the kids are smart, then the kids test better. And I feel like that happens to me in church. I feel like I'm thought so much less of, that the image is given to me and to my daughter.
Because of the non-inclusiveness of the language,
yeah.
Or because of the way that congregations in ministry?
Not inclusive language, who the leadership is, the way God is talked about, the way sort of wisdom in real, the holy of holies in thought is thought to be a very male kind of thing, that the sort of magic of religion is always talked about in very male terms, and so that I'm just the handmaiden, which feels pretty little to me. I can do the altar cloths and... it just doesn't make me feel like much of a person. That's why feminist theology to me is so exciting and wonderful and empowering and such a trip. It feels so energetic.
And this all comes out of that whole idea of what is our image as children of God. And one of the characteristics of feminist theology is it's not hierarchical. And that runs counter to everything in our society and in the world, that one person is valued more than another. The image that feminist theology is exclusive of men or anybody else, for me, is not part of that definition. Letty Russell wrote a book called Human Liberation in a Feminist Perspective. And that, for me, is a phrase that really characterizes more of what feminist theology is about. It seeks the liberation of all human beings. And it starts from the vantage point, from the beginning place of women's experience of feminist theology. And that as a point from which one can also lift out issues that need to be addressed in the church.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really important because I think some of the negative feelings that come toward Christian feminism or feminist theology are the feeling that women now just want to turn it around and make God a woman and, you know, get rid of the men.
Yeah, I don't,
That is not the way I would like to look at it.
Right, no, and I don't think, I know it's not necessary to look at it that way. The other thing about feminist theology also is it's holistic. It seeks to bring together in wholeness what is so often in our lives fragmented. Some of that fragmentation is imposed on us by others. We don't need to be fragmented. Sometimes we have to work awfully hard to bring wholeness to our environment, especially when there's forces that are pushing us out and we're moving in. But I think that, that holistic thing, and again, it's a struggle of centuries. The early centuries of the church, they still had the idea that the mind was good and matter was bad, and they operated under this dualism, and you know who was associated with matter? You know, women, they were matter, and the men had the ability to think. And ever since then, for all these hundreds of years, we've been trying to put it together that it's not superior. The only thing superior is the integration of all of ourselves as human beings, our feelings, our physical lives, our emotional lives, all that has to come together. And it has to come together in such a way that we respect each other in the different ways it comes together with us and that we seek to cooperate. The critique that was made earlier that feminist theology is not cooperative is really different from my experience of feminist theology as being very collective and very cooperative. The experience of women working together is one that really stands out. In seminary, we did some, somebody was testing us, some psychologist was testing us. And they had different groups of people do a project. It was a puzzle of some sort or another we had to put together. I can't remember what it was. And they had some mixed groups, men and women, and they had all men and they had all women. And it was just amazing how well the group of women worked together. I mean, they figured out their process right away, and they got it together. And, you know, the task wasn't that difficult, but the ability to come together and find a common process seems to come more easily to women. The men tended to choose somebody to be in charge, to tell everybody else what the process would be, because that would be more efficient. And women have been told this all the time, you're not efficient because you do things backwards, or, you know, you tell stories instead of laying it out the way it's supposed to be, or, you know, there's always something wrong with the way, but it works, you know, and women know it works, but again, it's something like nothing happened sort of thing, like it's not always visible to others. But I think feminist theology, both in the sharing of stories and the developing of that, is a very collective, a non-hierarchical and cooperative process, which is not to mean that there are not women in the world who may claim to be feminists or, you know, whatever, who operate in a whole other mode. We all know women who adopt hierarchical styles. We know women who opt for a system that is built that way and choose to go that way, but that's not my understanding of feminist theology. Yes?
Another question. You make a number of statements just in that period. What I wonder about, one of them was that the males in the past, say 50 years ago or 100 years ago, didn't think that women could think.
Yes, that's very, I didn't say that, but that's true.
And yeah. Why do you say that? In what context are you taking that?
Oh, okay, the question was, did I say that men in the past, say 50, 100 years ago, thought that women could not think, and what context would I make that conclusion out of it? I was talking of like, you know, 9,000 years ago or so, but in the context of 50 or 100 years ago, the very fact that women were not allowed to vote was because they felt women could not think well enough to cast an intelligent vote. And as we'd mentioned yesterday, too, in a group, women didn't discover that they were thought of that way until the whole slavery issue came up. They wanted to speak against slavery, and the men would not let them speak against slavery because they were women. And then they realized that they had a second problem. It wasn't just the slavery. It was also the fact that they, as women, were not allowed to participate and express that opinion. And then when it came after the Civil War, they worked for suffrage of all people. Black men were allowed to vote, and women were not, till 50 years later. And so there was a constant it's, you know, written down that, you know, women should not be allowed to do this.
Mm-hmm. I think evidence that in, say, 50 to 100 years ago, in my own college in particular, 50 years ago, colleges did not see women as worthy of educating because they were not admitted to their academic institution.
Yeah, it's not that long ago that higher education did not think women worthy of participation in
that. Well, is that because the problem I'm having is it's not clear to me that it's one of thought, thinking, and respect.
But
with orientation, you know, whether or not a woman goes to college or not, but what's behind that? It's not clear to me that what you're saying is necessarily the reason why women can go to college. There are a lot of other things that are involved in it. But it was interesting to hear what you said about
Yeah. No, if you go through history, you know, we could pick out lots of examples of that. So it's not an unfounded generalization. It's one that has been stated very clearly to women throughout history.
You don't have to go that far back.
When
Hubert Humphrey was running for president, perhaps you remember a character called Edgar Berman. He was an advisor, and as a matter of fact, much to my dismay, he was on the board of my college, and still is. But he made a comment that women could not be president because of their raging hormonal imbalances.
That's been a problem for men, yes. Accepting that women have bodies and concluding that that makes them unfit to think, that certain times of the month they can't think clearly, therefore we better not have a woman as president. That's been stated also very overtly. I'd mention a couple other things too about feminist theology. One has to do with, we talked about inclusive language, and probably if there's any issue that people are most aware of here, it's the issue of inclusive language, because Holden has worked with that language that does not exclude all people. Somebody had mentioned a couple of days ago about how painful it is to discover injustice done against yourself, because once you know it, you don't forget it and it hurts. There's a song some woman wrote that said, "I wish my eyes had never been opened. I wish I'd never learned how to see because of all the pain that I feel. It's more, you know, more than I can bear." And there's a lot of truth that you can't go back. Once I learn to include everybody in my language, when I am around people who exclude me, I really feel it very painfully and find it difficult to let that go by. And that's an important thing to realize. That so once you're embarked on this journey, there's no going back without really going back. But naming it has to do with a lot of other things too. And if you talk about theological categories, and I'm just thinking of one example for right now, but one of the categories that theologians always define are sin and grace and justification and all these things. The word sin has traditionally been interpreted as that of pride, this desire to be godlike. We want to be gods. And what's been ignored in that, for me, sin is more like, well, a coin is too narrow a definition. A coin only has two sides. It has many sides. But if you take a coin as an example, that excessive pride is only matched on the other side by an excessive self-effacement or lack of self-valuing that has been so much a part of women's experience that comes out of all the fears and the fragmentation and the oppression that women have experienced. And somehow that's never been lifted up as a category of sin, that to deny the worth that you have as God's child, to deny the talents that you have and not to act on those and to express those, for me, is an incredibly sinful waste that at least equals that sin of excessive pride. And so many times women have had that particular definition used against them to keep them subservient and submissive. And when you are assertive, they will say, well, no, you're getting too prideful. You know, whereas men are assertive, that's wonderful. That's what they're supposed to be. But what we've been doing is pushed down to another category of sin, I think, that's been remained sort of hidden on a naming level. We haven't called that what it is for us. Part of the oppression is also part of our sin. It's not that we're not capable of pride, but that's a much more common and I think, pervasive experience of sinfulness, of denying ourselves who we are.
Mm-hmm. I think sin has fallen short of expectations, of God's expectations of us.
Mm-hmm. If you define it that way, that's another way of falling short. But I think in a traditional male theology, that's been the traditional category. But your category, you know, encompasses both of those, which is helpful. So that's basically part of what all this redefining is. I think feminist theology is about relationships. It's about our relationship to God, our relationship to each other. It is not. I don't see it as a substitute for our Christian theology. I see it as a corrective to that theology, which it desperately needs right now because of its history of male definition and limitation for us. I think also that feminist theology is about vision. It's about the vision of God's intention and God's will for all people. That we're called upon to live out that vision in this reality and not to put that off to a later time. It's sort of like feminist theology points us back toward the original vision and creation of a world created for all people to equally enjoy. and pushes us towards a future realization of that that is to come.